Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Yep, it's me. Back from a number of weeks being absent from this seat, back from northern Wisconsin, where I rusticate and rest and relax a bit every year. Thanks to Jay Warner Wallace and Sean McDowell. And did Alan Schliemann fill in for me? I'm not sure. Maybe that's coming up. But all those fine men who sat in the chair, Amy Hall, I don't know, might have been here as well, but I know that you were in good hands while I was gone. And by the way, before I forget, since this particular part of the podcast comes out on Wednesday, tomorrow, Wednesday, when you'll be getting this podcast, I have an event in Newberry Park, California, Thousand Oaks area, Conejo Valley, Rabbit Valley, where I live, and I don't get to teach there too often, but when I do, I'd like to let you know about it. I'll be the anchor on a series called Get a Grip, and many of you listening have been going to that series one Wednesday night a month, a different speaker. Sean was one of those speakers, for example, and Abdu Murray was there, and Clay Watkins was there. Yeah, there was a great... Anyway, I get to anchor that series, and I will be there tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., and Newberry Park at Living Oaks Church. And you can get the information at livingoakschurch.org/events. We start at 6:30, go for a couple of hours, have some Q&A, and anyway, it's going to be a good... I'll be doing Columbo. So I'm trying to take everything that everyone has learned in the weeks leading up to the final week and show them how to put it into play with the Columbo tactic. So that's coming up. But I just I got home at about 2 in the morning, actually 1 in the morning, and then I got to bed about 2, and then had to get up at like what felt like the crack of dawn to me 6 hours later, and head to the office so I can be with you guys here today. But that's okay. I'm glad to be part of your day, and usually I have stories, right? When I go out my trip, I have stories. I was actually gone for almost 5 weeks, but nearly 2 weeks of that was work. I did some work in Minneapolis. I did some work in a camp in Wisconsin. I did a Sunday morning and evening at the Evangelical Free Church there, Faith EV Free in Woodruff, which I do every single year, and had a great time doing that. I didn't get much fishing done, partly because I got a new boat and I sold my old boat, and that takes a while, changing over gear, and I had to swap trolling motors, and then I had to get the old one cleaned up, and I had to get it sold before I could think about fishing. And then when I was ready to go fishing, it was raining like crazy. It was the last 2 weeks when my girls came up, my wife and two girls and one of my daughter's friends, so there was 4 against 1. Not just 3 against 1. However, my brother Dave was there working on a remodel with me, and I was doing help there. We're fixing the place up after 60 years or so and trying to get it in true working condition. So that was satisfying. I'll tell you a couple of things, though, that stood out. One of them is, and there was a picture of this on my Facebook, we found in its final throes of life a beautiful moth. It's called a Cecropia moth. It is the largest moth in North America, and it was a perfect specimen. I was able to pick it up and hold it in my hand because it was getting torpid, and this is on its way out, probably. And I wish we would have just stayed with it a little longer and then let it die a natural death and take it with us and display it somehow in the cabin, but it's a massive moth, almost completely covers my hand. So you can take a look at it on my Facebook if you'd like to see that. It's beautiful. When I was a kid, chasing butterflies and all kinds of insects and catching bats and all the things that I did in the outdoors, Cecropia moth was the creme de la creme. In fact, I don't think I had ever seen in the wild a full, complete, unmarred specimen. Every once in a while, I'd find what's left of one in the grill of my truck. driving through the night, picking up bits and pieces here and there, but this was a magnificent specimen. So that was great. Another thing I didn't see, but my wife did with the girls about 2 miles from our house, is a mama bear and three cubs, one, two, three, count them, crossing the highway. That was a big deal for them. Of course, we saw turkeys and fox. I saw four foxes and tons of deer and all kinds of wildlife. So it was been a raccoon. There was lots of lot of fun things that we did get to do and be together. So that was real satisfying for me. Plus, to see our place move forward and get in better shape as we're remodeling and still working on it. I got a team there working on it while I'm gone. But that was that was the kind of the vacation part. But part of the time I spent, and I do this every year, as I mentioned, I was at EV Free. They're in Woodruff and usually have a morning session or two of them, two services that morning, talked about atheism, bumping into reality. And in the evening, we have a Q&A session. I start with a couple of comments, much like I do on the show here. And then we open up to the audience for interactions, more informal. And I had been asked a question about the difficulty of winning people to Christ who are already in the church. And did I have anything to say about that? Did I have any insight on that? And actually, I don't have any insight, except for, in a certain sense, to provide a sober warning. The difficulty with working with people inside of the church who are not Christians is that they think they are. Now, this might sound very condescending, and that's not my project. It's not what I intend to be communicating. But the fact is, as many people know, there are lots of folk who sit in pews every Sunday, are part of the larger community of the church, who whose lives are not characterized by obedience to Christ. And therefore, they become the kind of people that outsiders point to as what's wrong with the church. Well, the church is filled with hypocrites. Well, in a certain sense, the church is filled with much worse than that, because that's where sinners go to get help, all right? That's one way of looking at it. But there are also people who grew up in the church, or it's a social enterprise for them. It's part of their culture. We find this a lot in the South. And they end up getting a little bit inoculated to the real thing. They get just enough of it to not get the good, what Francis, not Francis Schaeffer, but C.S. Lewis used to call the good infection. And so consequently, when we approach them, we can't win them because they think they're already won. We can't disciple them because they don't want to be discipled. They're kind of in that twilight zone. But from God's perspective, they're not. And this is one reason that I wrote a recent piece, and it might have already been delivered, or maybe this comes out in July, August. Maybe it's August. And I talk about my concerns about what I call the magic prayer, which is another way of characterizing the so-called sinner's prayer, the prayer that you pray to get into the kingdom. Now, I don't have any problem with the sinner's prayer per se, except for sometimes I prayed a version of it myself when I became a Christian almost 46 years ago. But what the difficulty is, is that people think if I say the words to the prayer, Lord Jesus, I need you, please come into my life and forgive my sins. I accept you as my Lord and Savior, something to that effect. If they can just say those words, then that's all that's necessary to kind of be in. And so if I ask regarding a relative of someone or children of a couple I know, well, do they know the Lord? They might say, well, they prayed the prayer. And the idea is they may be living like hell right now, but that's okay because they prayed the prayer, so they're covered. Now, that's not my theology. And my theology, as I explained to the person in the church and the rest listening, that if a person is living out like hell, they're probably going there. And it's not even in a certain sense, it doesn't even have to be that extreme. Because if they're living, if you read Romans chapter 8, there is a characterization of two types of people, one who lives according to the flesh and one who lives according to the Spirit. Now, the one living according to the Spirit, as Paul clarifies there, is one who owns the Spirit, who has the Spirit, who is regenerate. And if anyone does not have the Spirit of God, he is none of his. That's what Paul says there in that passage. Now, you are in the Spirit, but not in the flesh, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. So Paul is making a distinction between those people in the Spirit that is spiritually regenerate and those who are not, and those who are according to the flesh. And I've talked in the past about this being, thinking of this as just two separate trajectories. And the one in the flesh doesn't mean you're living like hell. I mean, if you were, then that would be in the flesh, but there are a lot of nice people who are also living according to the flesh. That is nice, sweet, wonderful people who do not have the Spirit of God and are not following Christ, but they're following their own moral code and their own ethical structure and maybe doing very well at that. And so don't look like someone who is living like hell. Okay, they don't look like that. They look like pretty fine people, but according to Paul, they're on that trajectory. So if a person, back to the original question, is on this other trajectory, they are just pretty much living like everybody else, and the things that concern Christ in the day-to-day don't concern them. Well, then that's probably because they are not connected to Christ. Now, having said that, of course, I'm making a judgment, right? I am saying there are people in the church that identify as Christians who are not Christians. And I'm also suggesting that the way you know that they're not Christians is they pretty much look like everyone else in their moral conduct, in their values, in their behavior, how they spend their money, how they use their time. I'm not talking about how they dress or whether they're, you know, hair, whether they have tattoos or not, or whether their hair is blonde or red or green or purple or all that other stuff. Those are somewhat inconsequential to me. It's not my culture. You know, I'm not comfortable with my girls looking that way, but that's a cultural thing, not a moral thing. I'm talking about how what people's functional worldview happens to be. And if their worldview, the way they function and their values and their behaviors and what they consider good and right and true and beautiful and all of that, it's just like everybody else who doesn't know Christ. It's probably because they're in that group. Now, there was an objection that was raised by someone in the audience. It was fair. I'm glad they did so that I could clarify. And the objection was, maybe it's not a good idea for us to be judging people in this way, making this kind of assessment. That is, maybe we shouldn't be saying who is in and who is out, because after all, different people have different histories. They have different lives. They're struggling with different issues. Somebody coming in to the body of Christ without very new as a Christian, maybe coming from a very, very moral place and look great to others, even though they're a couple of weeks old in Christ, where someone coming from a much more difficult moral environment may look awful even after years when compared to the brand new Christian I just described. So we need to deal with people individually. And C.S. Lewis made reference to this in one of his works. And what matters is not how we compare ourselves to other people, but how we compare ourselves to where we've been and the change that marks a genuine Christian. And I think there's merit to that. Okay. However, I don't think that completely absolves us of any responsibility on the one hand, or takes away any latitude we might have to make assessments on people's life. And I'm thinking especially of people who have children or close friends or whatever who prayed the prayer or something like that and who are now not making any show of fealty to Christ, faithfulness to Christ. What's up with that? And so on the one hand, I'm sympathetic to the concern raised by the woman to my response about evangelizing those in the church. And that concern was that some people have a harder time than other people, and I think we need to take that into consideration. At the same time, I don't think it removes from us any latitude of making judgments of any kind, because I think we ought to do that. In fact, Paul does it. He says in 1 Corinthians 5, he talks about there is an individual in the midst of the Corinthian church who's living a deeply immoral life, and nobody's done anything about it. And what he says is, remove the evil man from your midst. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. You let one evil person do their thing without addressing it, and more people are going to be doing that kind of thing. That's his point. And so this needs to be addressed. And then he makes a reference. He said, I told you not to associate with immoral people. I didn't mean the immoral people in the world, because then you'd have to go out of the world. In other words, we don't expect non-Christians to live like Christians. And we don't say, gee, I'm not going to mess, I'm not hanging out with any of those people because they're nasties. Well, Paul says, how are we going to help them if we get out of the world, because the people that need Christ are in the world, okay? He said, rather, I told you, now watch the language, not to associate with any so-called brother who was an immoral person or a swindler or idolater or covetous or a murderer or thief, or he's got a list of things going on there. And basically he's saying, discipline is for the church. We make certain kinds of assessments on people and judgments inside the church, and that's appropriate. And that's why he says, remove the wicked man. And anyway, so there's a kind of a balancing act that's going on here when we have to make these kinds of assessments. Think of James. James is clearly the show me guy. James chapter 2. He says, you show me your quote unquote faith. And I think that's the sense in which he means it. You show me your so-called faith without works, and I will show you my faith with my works. So we can't see faith. What we do is we see what the claim of faith, what difference it makes in our lives, the effect that it has in our behavior. James says, watch my behavior. I will show you that I have that invisible thing called faith that saves. But you say you have that invisible thing called faith that saves, and you have nothing to show for it. That's like a dead body. Like a body without the breath is a corpse. My paraphrase of what he says later. But a person who claims to be a Christian and lives out something of the Christian life, that's the evidence of salvation and justification. I'll tell you, as for me in general, I give a person the benefit of the doubt. I'm not a fruit inspector so much. I do have thoughts of my own mind, and when there are people close to me, that's when it's fair to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? But in my heart, I'll tell you, I just am most confident in those who are actively living for Christ. That, as I mentioned earlier, what matters to Christ, that is godliness, evangelism, the Great Commission, the church, Scripture, prayer, perseverance, what matters to Christ matters to those persons as well. Doesn't mean they execute perfectly every time. They don't. I don't either. Nobody does. But it matters. That's the trajectory that they're on. And that, I think, is where our confidence should be for our loved ones and for ourselves. Whereas Peter says, if these qualities, these virtues that he's just described are yours and increasing, it makes you more certain of God's calling for you. And so there is that affirmation that our own godliness not only shows others the place of Christ in our life, but it shows us the place of Christ in our life as well. And sometimes I think we do have cause to be concerned and to wonder, wait a minute, what's going on? Where actually am I really? Is this lip service? Is this a cultural thing? Am I just going through the motions? Do I love Christ? Do I care about the things that Jesus cares about? Am I living for him? Am I on a trajectory of the Spirit, Romans 8, or am I on a trajectory in which I look just pretty much like everybody else in the non-Christian world? Maybe nice people, but completely godless in terms of their values and the things they care about and the way they live their life. Anyway, so that was the conversation I had, something to think about. We have some callers on board, so let's get to them after this break. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
We are at war. It's not a war of bombs and bayonets. It's not a war against flesh and blood. In fact, it's not a physical war at all. It's a spiritual war. That's why Paul instructs us to put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. The devil's primary scheme is deception. He wants us to believe false ideas about God. And the only way to guard against false ideas is to fill our minds with true ideas. Simply put, we combat deception with truth. It's unfathomable to imagine sending young men and women off to fight a physical war without proper training. Yet, when it comes to spiritual warfare, we do this all the time. The vast majority of our students are simply not prepared for the spiritual battle that awaits them. At this year's Rethink Apologetics student conferences, we're training students to counter the lies of the enemy. Lies like God does not exist, God is anti-gay, Muslims and Christians worship the same God are just a few of the false ideas we'll be addressing. So join me and a number of other speakers at one of this year's Rethink Apologetics student conferences. Find out more information about Rethink by going to rethinkapologetics.com. That's rethinkapologetics.com.
Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show. My number, 855-243-9975. That's a number you can call whenever I'm on the show, which is most of the time, just not the last few weeks. And the time to call is from 4 until 6 p.m. Los Angeles time, Pacific daylight now at the moment. So that's the number. If you're outside the U.S., you can dial 562 after dialing the international number, which I think for us is 1-562-424-8229. Okay, let's go to our first caller, and it is Ricardo in Redlands, California. Hey, Ricardo.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, good. Thanks. What's up?
Well, quick question. I've been tagged to do this equity group at my school district, and one of the issues that's come up is Christians are the reason why so many in the LGBT community, especially transgender, mm-hmm. are committing suicide. So basically, it goes in line with what's trying to go through here in California, that that ACR 99, I believe it's called, to prevent pastors, anybody basically, from preaching that part of the Bible.
Right.
So basically, it's our fault. It's your fault why the LGBT community is committing suicide so much.
Yeah.
What evidence can I use? What research is out there?
Well, let me offer a couple of thoughts, and I have something that I could recommend to you. But it seems to me that on the face of it, this is an odd claim, all right? On the face of it, it strikes me as an odd claim. What a person is claiming is that someone commits suicide because I, as a Christian, think that homosexuality is wrong. Okay? So here's a question that I have. I'm just trying to take a common sense look at the claim. We'll look a little bit more at statistics in a minute. But just a common sense assessment. And I think most of the time common sense assessments are pretty reliable. So the person is saying, you think that my behavior and the way I live is wrong, and therefore I'm going to kill myself. Now, that's a little bit of an oversimplification, but it's kind of what it amounts to. Maybe there's a lot of people who think that that's the case, so that I'm going to kill myself. Okay. Do you think that there is more animus in culture right now, Ricardo, against gays than it is against Christians? What do you think?
Oh, definitely against Christians. I mean, you have to do is look at Taylor Swift's new video.
There you go. Okay. Every time you turn around, Christians are under attack, and they're under attack in vigorous and vicious ways, right? Do you see Christians committing suicide left and right?
No. And really quickly, I just read an article on NPR that Native American women suicide rates gone up 136%, and nowhere in the Bible is there anything about Native American women. So I just don't see that.
Now there may be a higher. You know, I'm not the statistician here, but my understanding is there is a higher suicide rate for LGBT types, and especially for gender dysphoric types, there is a high rate. But that is true, I know, regarding gender dysphoric, even in countries like Sweden, where you do not have what could be called social pressure against gender dysphoria. So this is a causal relationship is being claimed here. Here is the event, high suicide rates. What is the cause? It's Christians condemning homosexuality. That's to put it simply. But you have high suicide rates in countries with the same group, in countries where there are not Christians condemning homosexuality, okay? So that doesn't seem then to be the reason why there are high suicide rates, for one. Secondly, you have other groups of people who are routinely criticized and chastised aggressively everywhere, Christians, who are not following suit. So to make the claim that if a person is criticized as being wrong, that increases that person's chance of killing themselves, this strikes me as a specious kind of claim. And if we are to change our views regarding that so we don't drive somebody to it, well, then why doesn't the shoe fit on the other foot just as well? Then let's not find anything wrong with anyone lest they be tempted to commit suicide. I just think it seems to me a very unlikely line of thinking that people are committing suicide because of me, really, especially in a culture where the Christian's voice is aggressively being silenced and the rest of culture is championing in spades all of these, what do they call them, sexual minorities. So-called sexual minorities. They are being championed everywhere. You can't make one little blink in public against that without being chastised aggressively. Remember a few years ago during the football draft, when one football player who was just drafted kissed his boyfriend on the, you know, on the on TV, and one of the other players just text, "Oh my gosh, gross," or something like that, and he got seriously chastised or put on suspension just because in his own private email or texting he said something like that. My point is, the fact of the matter is that the pressure is not on the LGBT community, quite the opposite. They are getting all the accolades, it seems to me, in terms of cultural emphasis, and the ones the pressure is on is actually the Christians. So it doesn't strike me as sound to say that gays are killing themselves because of what Christians have to say. Okay? That's one thing. All right? It also, doesn't it strike you? There's a lot of noise there in the background, Ricardo. I don't know what that is, but...
Yeah, I was walking by.
Okay. Doesn't it strike you as a bit patronizing to gays that if someone just disagrees with their lifestyle, they are going to threaten to take their life? I just... that strikes me as unusual, you know? What happened to courage of convictions? That, by the way, that was raised by a gay writer. What about the courage of our convictions? Why do we have to demand that everybody walk in lockstep with us? So that's another thing that, I mean, just something to think about there. But I have in my hand, Amy Hall just gave this to me. It's a piece out of Science, the journal Science. Now, it says 6/25/19 here, but that's the date of the printing. That's today, right? Okay, so this is the title of this is Study. Oh, no, I know what this is. This is from the Federalist under their category of Science, and the headline is February 28th. Okay, thank you, Amy. February 28th. The title is Study. Claiming prejudice makes LGBT people die younger gets retracted. That's the headline here. And the underneath it, criticism of the study and its retraction got much less attention than the initial findings did, because initial findings supported the so-called right narrative. So it goes into some detail here. I'm not going to read it for you. But it's in the Federalist from February 28th. James Lopez, is that L-O-P-E-Z? Is that right? Okay, he is the author. Amy just found it and printed it for me, so you can find it easily yourself. Now, what's important about the claim that is made is it's a factual claim about a cause and effect relationship. How are you going to determine that the reason more LGBT types are vulnerable to suicide is because they're being challenged or criticized by Christians? How does one determine that? Well, that takes a certain kind of test. And apparently
I'm sorry. Here's the irony. When I try to do research online, the only articles that were popping out were, you know, studies show religion linked to transgender suicide. So that... just the research alone was kind of difficult.
Yeah, so, but even studies show, what I want to see is exactly how was the study done and what does it show? And this particular article, it's only two and a half pages, is meant to show why the study that was done that drew this conclusion was deeply flawed, and then the study itself got retracted because it was discredited. But the study got all kinds of publicity when it first came out, and then when it was retracted, got no publicity. So people are still left with a false conclusion regarding the statistics in the study, but it's a false conclusion that I think was counterintuitive anyway. In my thoughtful mind, let me put it that way, I had reason to distrust any survey that says that LGBT types are dying at a higher rate because Christians think that homosexuality is wrong. Christians are the ones having the oppression right now on that, especially on that issue. They are the ones being silenced, and everybody else is cheering them on. So why is then, in light of that, the LGBT suicide rates elevated? There might be a different reason, and it has nothing to do with criticism. It might be because LGBT folks understand that something is amiss. Things are not the way they're supposed to be with them, and that's why they feel this way. Which, by the way, I think that's true, and I think this is why they have such thin skin, because they don't want to be reminded of it by anybody at any time. And so they want to silence everybody, entirely silence the public voice on this when it speaks against them, and to exalt the public voice on it when it speaks in their favor. You still have these elevated suicide rates in the LGBT community. So I'm with you. I'm not willing to accept at face value any of that. And I think it's fair to challenge it. And if you want to take a look at this article, Study Claiming Prejudice Makes LGBT People Die, Younger Gets Retracted, from The Federalist by James Lopez.
No, I definitely do, because like I told you, I'm going to be on this equity committee, and that's one of the first things I've heard they're going to want to address.
Okay. If this is generally a problem, you know, then why don't we stop all criticism, including criticism of Christians? You know, if criticism makes people commit suicide, then we can't criticize anybody. I think
right.
This is just a foil. This is just another political gambit, a social gambit to try to silence dissent.
True.
That's all it is. So I'm glad we got someone like you that can take a stand and make the case. Especially when the studies, if don't let any person just toss out studies say, they need to produce the study and demonstrate that the study is credible first, before anything else. Fair enough?
Thank you. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I appreciate you taking your time and giving me the resources. And just to let you know, I got permission from my wife. We'll be supporting you guys.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you, Ricardo, and thank your wife as well. We're really happy to hear that.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
All the best. Bye-bye now. Well, there you go. What a nice way to end a conversation. But this kind of stuff happens all the time. If a study, generally when studies are sound and accurate, they merely support what common sense already tells you. This study apparently was not sound, didn't support common sense, but it turned out not to be sound and accurate based on this information that I've just read out of the Federalist here. No, I didn't read it to you because there's no time for it, but you guys can check it out. But you've seen this kind of thing happen. It's maddening. All right, let's take a break. More calls coming up on Stand to Reason.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. If you're faced with a tough question or an intense challenge from your non-Christian friends or family, why don't you answer like Jesus answered? Find out his three ways of answering tough questions in his day in the latest episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes or the top of the homepage at str.org.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store. We'll be right back.
All right, here I am. I was just reading part of this article that I made reference to earlier, a study claiming prejudice makes LGBT people die younger, gets retracted. And it talks about two competing studies, one by this Columbia University Associate Professor Mark Hatzenbuehler, publishing the study claiming to show the structural stigma, which the authors define as anti-gay prejudice, okay? But then, and that how everybody covered it, and it got all kinds of publicity. However, when another study came out questioning it, Regnerus, is it Mark Regnerus? Is that his name? Yeah, from University of Texas. I'm looking for that first reference. When he published a piece based on his own research, he was vilified and, you know, his computer was taken away from him by UT Austin. And eventually he was cleared of all allegations and his material, you know, is still in play. The point is, it just shows the prejudice when it comes to these particular things. When the first study is published, that showing a link between anti-gay prejudice and reduced life expectancy, news coverage is rampant, this author notes, but when Regnerus publishes his results directly challenging the paper's key findings, the media did not do its due diligence in covering it. Okay, so there you go. And that kind of thing happens a lot. Oh, studies say, blah, blah, blah. Well, common sense can sometimes tell you quite differently. And when you look closer at those studies that violate common sense, oftentimes the studies themselves are not well done. Let's go to Richard in San Diego. Hey, Richard.
Welcome back, Greg.
Thank you.
I am a pastor, part of a pastoral team in San Diego, received a telephone call from a family in another state, and they found out that their 14-year-old son was not only cutting himself, but was now professing to be an atheist. And so they were hit with a double whammy at the same time.
Sure.
And so I'm just curious. I've spoken to them at length on this. I'm just their safety in the multitude of counselors, and I'm interested in how they should take this tack with their son.
Well, this is really, really a sad situation and strikes very close home for me. I mean, I've heard this story before. And the cutting indicates emotional distress. And the cutting is meant by the person who's doing the cutting to relieve the distress, and apparently to some degree it does. I personally do not understand it, but this is the way it works, and there are a lot of young people are doing it, which means there are a lot of young people apparently that are deeply distressed with the circumstance they're living in. Now, what does that mean? Why is that the case? Well, partly because they're young people, and partly because culture is in complete upheaval. When culture was stabilized and there was a clear path from childhood to adulthood for everyone, and it had been followed for ages and ages, you didn't have this kind of confusion. But now all of those things are questioned, and there's no roots anymore. There are no clear roots for people. I mean, R-O-U-T-E-S, the roots or routes that people take to accomplish adulthood. And in another sense, there are no roots, R-O-O-T-S, for those young people. And so it's not surprising they experience high levels of anxiety. And now this isn't my field. I'm not a psychologist. I'm just kind of making an observation, but I think this is one reason. Well, let me put it this way. Why is it so many people are cutting themselves now and nobody ever did this before?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we also have a culture that is in the largest upheaval it's ever been in, questioning all of the, not just questioning, but rejecting all of the boundaries that that used to define civility, that used to define virtue and vice, that used to divine beauty and goodness. When all of those things are rejected, what's there? The only thing that's there is one's raw existential moment, what they're experiencing themselves. And this is not a pretty picture because human beings are fallen. And when they are left to their own devices, they make bad decisions because it's driven on their fallenness. So I think that I'm just talking in a general sense now about the cutting, what that suggests. Happy people don't cut themselves. All right, so something is wrong. I think the cutting is more telling than the atheism, but I wouldn't disregard that. I've talked to a number of people recently whose young teenager has gone through a period of atheism in rebellion, and especially if the parents are Christians, for them to reject the religion of their parents by declaring themselves atheist is a very aggressive poke in the eye to their parents. And that may be motivating it, the atheism part. I don't think they're cutting to poke their parents in the eye, though I can see how their parents would really feel bad about that. But I think that the atheism is, okay, here, take that. I don't have to believe what you believe, kind of thing. And that may be just a feature of rebellion associated with that period of life where a person is so confused and so filled with stress and angst that they cut themselves to make themselves feel better. So what's the antidote on this one? Well, I'm not the expert in this because I'm a father of a 14-year-old and 11-year-old, and I would never suggest to anyone that I'm doing the best job as being a dad to them. But I know one thing that I'm learning more and more, to listen more than talk. And to not be... When I first started... encountering some of this in my own children, it was shocked me. I mean, some of the signs of a young adolescence and rebellion, and it shocked me and it angered me, and I reacted in kind, and that wasn't healthy. That wasn't good for them. It wasn't good for me. So now I need to listen, and I think it's really important for young people to be heard. Doesn't mean we affirm their views, doesn't mean we applaud what they believe or what they're doing, but it's important for them to be heard, and have a sense that they are validated as individuals in the hearing. Okay. So if a person says he's an atheist and this person is cutting, a young person, I'd want to know, well, when you're an atheist, why? What do you mean by you're an atheist now? Did you used to believe in God and don't believe in God now? Or what is your conviction, and why do you believe this? And if you're cutting, what does cutting do for you? Now, the key here, though, is to, and this is the hardest part, Richard, is to have a calm demeanor and not a scowl and a harshness that would be completely understandable under those circumstances. But to allow the person to communicate themselves. This is a time where young people are going through lots of hormonal changes, and they're trying to figure out where they are in the world, and they don't have a map. Cultures used to have maps, and many cultures still do, but Western culture doesn't. Western culture has thrown the map out and said, "We're remaking our own map. We're writing our all new rules." Okay, and what this means, and this creates a tremendous amount of disorder. You know how people say celebrate diversity? Diversity results in conflict. When the more diversity that you have, the more conflict you have.
That's right.
Think about getting married. Are you married?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, 40 years next.
Okay, there you go.
Year.
What if you married a woman that was completely diverse from you, culturally, values-wise, desires, ways you use your time? Can you see how that's not going to make a happy home for either of you?
Right.
But if you have similarities in all the ways that matter, you're not diverse in the ways that matter, there's more there's more teamwork that goes on and that kind of thing. So this all goes to the point here of an observation that they're living in a world without a map. The map is being taken away from them. They're told the map is abusive, it's evil, it's racist, whatever. And sometimes in any map can be that way, all right? Every group has its liabilities, but there is no passage now. I can't think of anything that now is considered a rite of passage to adulthood.
Right.
A person works at something to be able to earn the right to be called a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone.
Yeah.
So now what? Now, they're going to grow up, that is, they're growing into physical adulthood, but with that supposedly comes a number of mature virtues that allow them to successfully maneuver in culture and survive in life.
Right.
But if they are not taught those virtues, because there is no list of such virtues, then what? Angst.
Yes.
And angst, I think, is what is being expressed when people cut themselves.
Fantastic. I really do appreciate that. I talk to people all the time, and I have this desire to see us create, especially within the Christian community, for the lack of a better term, a Christian bar mitzvah, where there's no rite of passage.
Right.
I've been to a bar mitzvah, and it was extraordinary. I was excited, but the work that young man had to go through in order to prepare for that, it was months and months and months and months.
Yeah.
And I've been with Christians who've taken like-minded older men and given them a character qualities and let them speak that quality into their son's life.
Sure.
At their birthday party.
Sure.
And I think the closest I've ever seen for us having a rite of passage,
sure.
a coming of age. And like you said, it's totally missing in our society.
Right.
Kids are growing up. Giving them the keys to a car is not a rite of passage. That's just plain dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's happening? I know people have said this, and you talk about rite of passage. You've got the Australian Aboriginals and the walkabout, and you've got in America, in different countries, they have different, the Swahili not Swahili. Those are the tall ones. They kill a lion or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they've got these kinds of things where a person can become an adult. But this, you're right, this is kind of missing. And some Christian groups have tried to put it together. But one thing that I hear people saying, and this goes to the point here, is that kids grow up so fast nowadays. But I don't think that's actually true. I think what's happening is kids are given the responsibilities. I'm sorry, they're giving the privileges of adulthood.
Without the responsibilities.
Pardon me?
Without the responsibility.
Without the responsibility. So they don't earn it. It's just given to them. They have no responsibility, and so they are given the adult privileges, no responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't cause them to grow up. It corrupts their souls. It corrupts their souls, and they don't use the responsibility well because they haven't stepped up to it in a manner that will enable them to do that. Now, there in some Christian communities, you have something more well established, but when you have young people that are feeding from the trough of the culture so aggressively through their screens, the internet, all of their texting, all the little videos and the YouTubes and all this, they are being discipled very aggressively by people who have a worldview in which there is no map. The map is feelings and pleasure and do your own thing and you belong to yourself and don't let anybody tell you what you should do.
Wow.
And you see this in all kinds of places, you know. The same theme as being, but kids don't know what they're supposed to do because they haven't been trained in virtue. They don't know how the world works, and consequently, their soul gets corrupted. They get they're filled with angst and anxiety and dread and depression, and they cut themselves or attempt suicide.
Well, thank you so very much. You know, it sounds, you know, like the book of Ecclesiastes, vanity, vanity. You know, experienced everything, and it's still all empty. And we have a society that's feeding our kids all kinds of information, and they have no way to process it.
That's right. Let me recommend a book to you. My recommendation regarding the young man you were talking about is to listen, just to get him to talk, and let him unfold and let him feel like he's been heard. Okay, that's my specific recommendation. But there is a book that we bought a while back with the best intentions. We haven't used it yet, although a few weeks ago I read a bit of it. And the book is written by two teenagers, and the title of the book is Do Hard Things.
I read it. I've read it, and I've recommended it, and I've given it to all kinds of people. It revolutionized my thinking in regards to just about everything in my Christian life.
Yeah.
And so Do Hard Things, I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
And they were 16 years old at the time when they wrote
that. Yeah. Well, they also pointed out that the word teenager didn't come into common vocabulary until, 1942 or something like that.
Right.
Before kids went from children into adulthood. And that's what bar mitzvah was at 13, for goodness sake, 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned in their book, 12, 13-year-olds were actually commanding tall-masted ships 200 years ago. So, and anyway, Do Hard Things. It's a great book, and it does address some of the things you're talking about here. But I recommend that regarding anyone whose child is in a circumstance that you just described, take the blades away from them, comfort them, listen to them, tell them you care, and let them talk. And I need to follow that advice just as much as anyone else. Thank you for your call, Richard. That's it for this hour, friends. Thanks so much for being part of what we do. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.